He has been totally demonized. Hilaire Belloc has been totally demonized. Not only can you not mention the Jews as anti-Semitic, you now it's obligatory in Catholic circles even to say he was an anti-Semite. He was not an anti-Semite. What Catholics believe is antithetical to anti-Semitism. This is all purely a function of the Jewish control of the Catholic mind right now. That somebody like Joe Pierce could write a biography of Belloc and say he was an anti-Semite. Preposterous. This was an awful book. Why is that? Well, he feels he has to accept the canons of discourse that have been established by polite people in this world, and that means adopting Jewish categories and dealing with one of your own people. I mean, where is this going to stop? This is what I keep asking. Is St. John Chrysostom an anti-Semite? He wrote a book called Adversos Judaeos, in which he says all sorts of awful things about Jews. Okay, is he an anti-Semite? It means he's a bad person. That means he's not a saint. You can't be a bad person and a saint, right? So that means the Catholic Church got this wrong. It is fundamentally unreliable when it tells you this is a good person. Okay, what about St. John? He wrote one of the Gospels, which is the basis of the faith we believe. Is he an anti-Semite? Yes, of course he is, according to certain Jews. I've quoted them in the book. Where is this going to stop? This is preposterous. People now realize they no longer have to maintain an untenable position, and now they are allowed to talk about something that is on everybody's mind. We now have a way of talking about this that is legitimate. Theologically legitimate, based on the 2,000-year tradition of the Catholic Church, because you don't want to incur the anger of the Jewish commissar. So we've internalized the Jewish commissar. To use Sigmund Freud's terms, who was a Jewish commissar, if there ever was one, we have this Jewish superego now.
That each man must live as an end in himself and follow his own rational self-interest.
We need to liberate ourselves from the Jewish superego. And I'm saying the only really effective way to do this is through Christianity. And in specific, the Catholic Church. Because the Catholic Church has a history of dealing with the Jews that has been proven over time. An effective way of dealing with the Jews. A modus vivendi, secret Judaeus non. The trouble is, over the past 60 years or so, 50 years or so, we have been pretending there are no problems. Well, we can't go on pretending anymore. We have been pretending that Jews are our friends. That's preposterous. We can't pretend this anymore. Those days are over. And you'll find it, one person after another will tell you when this happened. When did I realize that the Jews were no longer our friends? In my case, the instance that got me started on this book was Daniel Goldhagen's attack on Pius XII. A totally dishonest piece of anti-scholarship. Twisting phrases, thinking that maybe the Goyim, they can't read Italian, can they? I mean, that twisting of Eugenio Pacelli's statement about what he saw in the Wittelsbacher Palace, all that type of stuff, that was dishonest. And I think Goldhagen's reputation has suffered as a result. I think that everybody knows that was a specious piece of scholarship. But what it did, the positive effect, and it's not only, I am not the only person who has said this. There are other people I know who have written books who have said to me, it was Goldhagen that got me started on this thing. You realize, is this the fruit of all of these years of dialogue with the Jews? That you're going to have this guy being promoted by every Jewish organization as some type of scholar, and a scholar at Harvard University, to come up with this type of specious drivel, and suddenly something snapped, and I realized, no, there's got to be a better explanation. And this book is my attempt to free discourse from that type of hegemony. We have internalized the commands of our oppressors. And there are Jews who say this. Yuri Slezkin has written a book called The Jewish Century, in which he says on the very first paragraph, we're all Jews now. Well, what he means is that we all have imposed Jewish categories on our minds. And as a result, we cannot think properly. It's that simple. Because the crux of the book that I wrote here is that the essence of Jewish identity is rebellion against Logos. The Jews, for the most part, rejected Jesus Christ, called for his death, and had him executed by the Roman authorities. That is an act of such magnitude that it will in fact affect all of history afterwards, simply because of the person of who it was, but by what you're doing here is you are rejecting Logos. If you reject that order, you are rejecting the moral order, you are rejecting the political order, you are rejecting the economic order, you are rejecting every order, and what you're establishing is a revolutionary compulsion in its place that will wreck society. Okay, that's why it's important. That's why this is important. That's why it's important to break through basically the Jewish control of our minds that took place when we all went to college and we studied people like Sigmund Freud, to break through that to the logos of reality, reason, the order of the universe, and then start dealing with realities rather than fictions. She was a Russian Jew who came over and got a job in Hollywood and was just totally enamored of America. But what you see in her books is kind of like the Jewish version of America. And so it's money, it's capitalism. Her favorite pin was like a dollar sign that she used to have. She thought Gary Cooper was the quintessential American, and so she created these kind of myths that became powerful for a certain group of people who were kind of leaning in that way anyway. It was kind of like a simplification, a stripping down of American life and religious life.
His highest moral purpose is the achievement of his own happiness.
And so there would be people who would be caught up in objectivism who were Catholic. My oldest son's generation, when they were in college, they were sick of all the liberal stuff, and so this seemed to be like an alternative to liberal stuff. And they go to these objectivist meetings and then they realize, wait a minute, this is a Jewish operation. And the goyim are kind of second-class citizens who just kind of go along with something that is basically not in their interests. I mean, if there were ever a classic instance of internalizing the commands of your oppressors, it is Ayn Rand's objectivist philosophy.
I'm challenging the moral code of altruism, the precept that man's moral duty is to live for others. I'm challenging the moral code of altruism.
Roth became famous in 1969 with the publication of Portnoy's Complaint. And it had a huge effect on subsequent literature. Erica Jong's Fear of Flying is basically the female version of Philip Roth. And Woody Allen's Annie Hall is basically Philip Roth.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
Why? I was just expressing a healthy sexual curiosity.
6-year-old boys don't have girls on their minds.
I did.
It's Portnoy's Complaint, you know, transposed into Woody Allen's life. So the warning that Henry Ford made, the battle that the Catholics fought to keep all this stuff out of Hollywood films and television, was lost in 65. And once the battle was lost, the Jews pursued their advantage by promoting pornography and then promoting writers who were clearly influenced by this pornographic culture. And Philip Roth was one of them. What comes out in the book is basically the Jewish animus against the goyim, expressed sexually. There's something at least human about Portnoy's Complaint. But what you see is, as the books go on, the animus becomes more and more overt and more strident, and the humor just sorts of disappears. Whatever humor there was in Portnoy's Complaint is gone by the time you get to the later books. It's all just pure aggression. If you promote sexual liberation, your group is going to succumb to sexual liberation. And the net result of sexual liberation is you die out, is the lack of offspring. That's the net result of sexual liberation. And so why wouldn't they succumb? The same thing happened to the WASP ruling class. I dealt with this in my book, Libido Dominandi. Arthur Packard, who was head of the Rockefeller Foundation, wrote a memo in which he said, I do not like Planned Parenthood because Planned Parenthood is promoting across-the-board contraception. We do not believe in across-the-board contraception. We believe that certain people should limit their families and that other people, namely we, should not limit our families. And we are being destroyed by Planned Parenthood because our offspring are the first people that march into the Planned Parenthood office. Same thing applies to Jews. The same thing applies to the Jews, ceteris paribus with Jews and pornography as it applied to WASPs and contraception. Marx was clearly did not think of himself as a Jew. And I think you'll find this among leftists across the board. Trotsky is the classic example. He did not identify as a Jew at all. And he thought that the Jews were on the other side and the Jewish capitalism was the enemy and that he was going to be an anti-Jewish Jew. But I'm saying that the only reason he felt that was because of the Jewish revolutionary spirit, that he internalized the spirit. And so it becomes, as you know, complicated by the 19th century because you have both sides being dominated by Jews who were fighting. Now you've got the same thing. You've got Norman Finkelstein, who is in that tradition, the Marxist tradition, fighting against the Jews in the Zionist tradition. So you have this intra-Jewish battle going on again. I remember being at a conference in Washington, and they had this guy, Tyndall, who was head of the BNP, British National Party, in the 70s. And he gave a speech in which he said how we should all be proud to be white guys. And then as an example of white culture, he mentioned Elizabethan England. That's when the Catholics were being drawn and quartered, you know. So in other words, it's not going to fly. Are the Irish white? And Tyndall says, of course they're white. My mother's Irish. Are Jews white? And Tyndall says, I don't know. It got to the heart of this ridiculous ideology of white guys. I don't believe in white guys. I don't believe that there was a time in America, if you lived in the South, you were a Protestant, and there was a large ferment going on called the Civil Rights Movement that polarized both sides. If you lived in the North, you were Irish and you were Catholic and you were Polish and all that other type of stuff. And that's the type of identity, ethnic identity, that is real. And so what you have now is a guy like Pat Buchanan, who just sent me his latest book with a nice, flattering, you know, inscription on the front of it, saying that we white guys have to stick together. Pat, you're not a white guy. You're a Catholic. Catholics are not white guys. I don't know what I have to say. And I think that there is an element of Jewish misdirection leading people into this trap. Do you know what I mean? Because they can manage that. Whereas they cannot manage a resurrection of Catholic identity. They can't manage that. Nazism was itself a false identity. I mean, Germany, you were Protestant or you were Catholic. And that's the unfortunate situation after the Reformation and the 30 Years' War. And so what he tried to do was come up with some type of confection that was based on Wagner. It was a pre-Christian identity. It doesn't work. Doesn't work. It fails. And I'm saying this white guy stuff is going to fail. And whether you think it's right or it's preposterous, it's not going to work. To go back to somebody like Madison Grant didn't believe in white guys. I feel like if Kevin were in the room here, I'd try and bring this to his attention.
When I was growing up, you know, America was 90% white. I had a sense of, you know, white Anglo-Saxon culture as being sort of our culture, you know, and even though I wasn't really Anglo-Saxon, I identified with it and believed in it. But now it's completely gone.
If you read Madison Grant's book, he says Europe is composed of three races, the Teutonic, the Mediterranean, and the Alpine. And only the Teutonic race should be allowed into America. Well, he doesn't believe in white guys. It has no roots. It's got no basis in anything. And then you get, well, what are white guy values? I once ran a cover of Fidelity magazine. The title was White People and Their Values. And I put a picture of Mother Teresa and Joseph Stalin on the side by side on the cover. It becomes an empty category that you can then fill with whatever you want to for purposes of political manipulation. Whereas that is not true of Catholic, Protestant, and Jew. These are real ethnic identities in America. And I think that that's what we have to get back to. I'm saying white is like goy. What is white? It's not black. Read the thing I did on Slaughter of Cities. The polls in Chicago in 1910 referred to Protestants as white people. These people didn't know they were white. This was the interesting thing about that conflict when Martin Luther King shows up in Chicago in 1966. Why are they white? Because Martin Luther King's here, that's why they're white. Otherwise, they were Lithuanians. It was the Lithuanians who threw rocks at him. You know, when he got out of the car and got hit in the head with a rock, they were Lithuanians, but they were being portrayed as white people. It's a false identity. It's going nowhere. You're not white, Pat. It's not an identity. Identity in America is religious identity. Religious identity is ethnic identity in America. This is not my idea. It's called the triple melting pot. It says that after three generations, country of origin ceases to be your source of identity and religion becomes your source of identity. And so America is Protestant, Catholic, Jew. That's what you are in America. And that's the source of your identity. And if you're not that, then you're prey to pseudo-identity. And pseudo-identity are NASCAR dads, which are consumer groups. They used to be called blue-collar workers. Now they're a consumer group called NASCAR dads. Harley-Davidson riders are another pseudo-group that used to be blue-collar workers. And I'm saying white guy is a pseudo-identity that is created to keep people enslaved.
Before we turn stone cold, we'd like to have a few last thrills. Riding the highways over the hills, picture Mr. and Mrs. Jones, thatching helmets and microphones, rolling down the road of life, trucking before they die. Son, I'm buying your mom a Honda Goldwing, a Honda Goldwing, a Honda Goldwing.